You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today. Smartphones and tablets are drastically changing the way we live, but the role that new technologies will play in education and in the development of future generations is anyone's guess. Shelley Pasnick, director of the Center for Children and Technology, is here to talk about how new technology is affecting our children's lives. We will be taking your calls. Give us a call at 646-829-3985. I'm interested in hearing how you use and moderate the use of technology within your family. Are your kids only allowed to use the iPad once a week? And what are they allowed to use it for? Can they watch TV shows on them? Or are they only supposed to use them for educational games? And what do you consider an educational game? Is it educational for your youngster to do Fruit Ninja, for example, because it's teaching eye-hand coordination? Or do you feel that that's not up to snuff? Tell me what the parameters are of your kids using technology in your family life. 646-829-3985. 646-829-3985. And Shelley Pasnick, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me here.
So we know computers can help kids learn, but where is the research going on what types of learning should be facilitated?
There's an abundance of research that's taking place right now, and it's really looking at specific applications of technology and how it supports learning. It's really quite silly to think about how technology helps kids learn. So the research is trying to get very specific on what kinds of learning and what kinds of contexts. So, for example, games that support skill development is very different from games that support content knowledge, and that, again, is different from games that would support conceptual knowledge.
Can you give me some examples of some of these games that illustrate these different areas that you just described?
Sure. So some of the work that we're doing at the center right now is focused more on the conceptual knowledge. We looked at the common misconceptions that young people have when it comes to science, and we're looking specifically at seventh graders. And what we found is that if you looked at some previous research that looked at what Harvard students would know about something like photosynthesis, they tend to carry with them these misconceptions about what photosynthesis really is. And so we're creating a game that is the development of a biobot, and it has features an archaeologist who's an explorer, and really thinking about how hydrogen molecules and carbon dioxide come together to form glucose, and that's mimicking the process of photosynthesis. So that's quite different than a game that, let's say, is going to drill the alphabet, or that would drill other kinds of skills.
Are these games any fun?
I leave that to the players to determine whether they're any fun. That's certainly a goal. It's a delicate balance trying to think about the experience, the engagement, the fun, the play, while also thinking about the learning.
Virtual teaching tools probably change the way students actually understand information. You know, all this stuff we've been reading about, the New York Times especially has been focusing on this, about how technology is actually rewiring our brains, where multitasking is rewiring our brains. Is there research expressing concern about that for kids?
Sure. And I think it's still, there is a lot of speculation about how media and technology experiences do shape young people and adults alike. And you're right, the New York Times in particular has taken a great interest. But I think it's still way too early to know. And less than placing the emphasis on the neurology and the rewiring of brains, really thinking about the social interactions and what happens when young people and adults come together in intergenerational spaces and really start to play. That's where a lot of the research that we do resides, rather than really getting into the neurological pathways and what chemicals firing and when.
I'm Amy Eddings, hosting for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Shelley Pasnick. She's director of the Center for Children and Technology, about the role of technology in family life and in childhood education. Shelley, Is there a difference between playing with blocks in the real world and representations of blocks on screen?
Sure. And both can be valuable. And this is something that's getting a lot of attention right now with tablets. And we tend to think of iPads when we say tablets. The gestural movement that's possible allows young children to manipulate and really explore a concept, for example, math and the idea of fair sharing. So you could move around slices of pizza and decide how many of pieces of pizza your friends may get. And that sort of manipulation could be similar to thinking about playing with blocks or distributing, you know, that you get two blue ones and my friend Raul gets three green ones. So there can be some similarities, but there also can be some differences.
Is any one better than the other? Do you want kids to be playing spatially with blocks first and not get them too addicted to your iPad early on?
Well, it's funny in asking that question, we use the word what's better and also addiction. And these tend to be the ways that we frame questions about technology. We're really worried about whether children are going to become addicted too early and also what's first. I mean, as Americans, we love to rank, we love to judge, we love to evaluate. And instead, why not think about both experiences and not necessarily privileging one or the other? They both have their advantages. And I think anyone who's really thoughtfully thinking about technology doesn't want to replace the experiences that kids have with blocks and in the what people like to call the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So getting dirty, getting messy, and that, how do you foster that messiness in all sorts of settings?
I wanted to return to something that you raised, this issue of sociability and technology. My image of the modern child is sitting in the back seat of the car with their thumbs going madly as they're playing their little games. Mm-hmm. Great for mom and dad because it keeps the kid occupied, but then you also take that same kid and you put him in a room full of people at Thanksgiving and he's at the Thanksgiving table with the thumbs going. You know, do we find that technology, especially these little handheld devices, portable devices that can go anywhere and be with us at any time, are creating sociability problems between kids and their parents, kids and their siblings, kids and their peers?
It can. It varies child by child and what the expectations in any household are. And we love to hold on to that image of technology as isolating. When in fact, many of the surveys that look at the way young people are using media, they use it to engage with their peers. And they get a lot more out of those experiences when the gameplay involves multiple players, whether they're in a room together, a la Wii or Kinect, or whether they're working with friends, let's say in Club Penguin, where they're not in the same room. As far as setting limits, though, that really comes to the parent to determine what the expectations are. Some modeling is important. You conjured up the image of the young person sitting, thumbing in the back seat. What about the mom or the dad on the BlackBerry? Not necessarily.
Thumbing in the front seat.
Right.
Yeah.
So it works in a lot of different directions.
Jenny from Washington Heights, you're on WNYC with our guest, Shelley Pasnick. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a stay-at-home mom currently with four kids. I've got a 13 and a 10-year-old, and then I also have 3 and 2-year-olds. Before I had kids, I was really a technology junkie. And I think as my older boys, got older, I got very into my computer as well. But when my new ones were born, we kind of decided to make a no-technology house. We got rid of our video games, and we just have a couple of laptops for little surfing for Dad and I. But I really wanted to create a space where family games are important and playing with blocks and all of that. However, I think I might have taken it a little too far now. My oldest sons really see technology now as a reward and crave it almost like forbidden candy bars. And I'm trying to find a way to better incorporate technology into the older boys' lives, but also limit the magic and the addictive qualities of it for my younger ones and for myself. Any advice would be greatly appreciated.
Thanks a lot, Jenny, for your call. And there's that word again, addictive. And I think it comes out of our own experiences of it, our adult experiences of it, that we do find it something that we're really drawn to over and over again whether we're driving or we're in the office or at home.
Yeah, there's no avoiding that it can be exciting. The new information coming in, the new piece of correspondence, whether it's via text or an email message. I think with the older children, though, you can start to have a conversation and engage with them about what rule setting or what the expectations are, that it doesn't necessarily need to be a single approach for every child. Nothing in parenting really would require that. Instead, you're wanting to adapt to each child and what their needs are. A lot of parents worry about technology as a displacement. So it displaces time spent outdoors or time spent engaging in physical activity, time spent socializing or on in academic pursuits. And all of those are elements of a healthy experience. And so with your older children, thinking about what role it might play, and also not necessarily to treat it, as you're saying, as a reward, but are you involved in the gameplay? Adults tend to be more comfortable engaging with their kids with older media. So whether it's books or board games, television is still king in families. So are you playing games with them? Are you using it to explore websites, to open up new places or new experiences? And so that shoulder-to-shoulder experience, rather than saying, yes, you're right, you haven't been on the computer, and let them go for, the 2 hours without any engagement.
But it is hard. You talk about being shoulder-to-shoulder. It is hard to sit and face a computer together.
Well, and
it's not designed for two people to be on it.
It's not, and that's where tablets, I think, are starting to change the experience. The way we look at the screen, the way we can pass around the screen is quite different than being anchored to a desktop or even to a laptop, that it's easier to pass around.
We have another call. Laura from Hastings-on-Hudson, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Laura.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have two high school girls, and the issue we face, particularly with my younger one, is that we can try to limit her internet time and tell her to get off the internet and do her homework, and we find that she requires the internet in order to get her homework done, whether it's going to the teacher's e-chalk page to pick up the assignments or other internet research she needs to be doing, and she has to constantly be fighting the distraction of Facebook and Tumblr and the websites she wants to visit in order to try to get her homework done. And even when she doesn't need the internet, we find that if she has to type up her assignments, she's still sitting at the computer. So the technology that we try to keep her away from, she's requiring in order to do her work.
A conundrum, Laura. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Certainly, and I don't think you're alone. But talking to your daughter about what her experience is with those distractions, they can be turned off, and maybe talking about increments of time. So 30 minutes, really focusing on typing up that paper, and then taking a break. Whether that's a break to walk around the block, or that's a break to check in with friends. That might be one approach. Again, different students require different habits about concerning how they're going to use the influence and the input coming from external sources.
But you're saying, though, that some programs can be turned off so that they're not distracted by the pinging of email messages coming in or new Facebook messages.
Sure. When you're typing up a document in Word, there's no reason why you need to necessarily have anything else turned on. Mm-hmm. That is possible. I mean, we tend to forget that, that we have this expectation of the always on or always connected. And that can be intoxicating. It can be joyful to have that experience of people coming to you with their news or with their questions, whether it's, your friends sharing something that they've heard, but you can turn it off.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a lot of what you're talking about is teaching children time management and how to organize their time online. We can't, as our first caller suggested, keep them forever away from it. At some point, schools will require them to be on the computer and online and surfing the internet. But it's about limits, setting up limits in terms of usage, rewards in terms of, okay, 10 minutes to check your Facebook page, and then you need to come back and focus on your research and on the computer project you're creating. Mm-hmm. So it's about a very mature concept, which is time management and planning your day.
Right, or what developmental psychologists tend to refer to as self-regulation. And that's something that we all must experience. And I think you're probably doing a disservice to your children if you are the one who's solely setting those limits and not having a conversation, not having them attend to their own feelings and their own responses to different stimulation, whether it's something coming via a website or something coming, you know, through the front door, to really understand how they respond and what their expectations are of themselves. You know, the sooner that conversation can happen when it is developmentally appropriate, the better the young person is going to be in making smart, healthy choices.
This is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard today, and I'm speaking with Shelley Pasnik, director of the Center for Children and Technology, and we are taking your questions about technology in the home. Give us a call at 646-829-3985, 646-829-3985. This is WNYC. It's the Leonard Lopate Show here on WNYC. I'm Amy Eddings, speaking with Shelley Pasnik, director of the Center for Children and Technology, about how new technology is affecting our children's lives and family life. And we're taking your calls, 646-829-3985. Francisco from Brooklyn, you're on WNYC and on the Leonard Lopate Show. Hi, Francisco.
Hi, good afternoon. My comment is I have a 10-year-old, and I don't want to know nothing about computers. I don't want to know nothing about Facebook, Twitter, all these video games. The kids are becoming vegetables. They're becoming stupid and dumb. My son and I, we spend every weekend outdoor making a business. We go to the beach. We go to the park. We play sports, ride bicycles, go to the movies. I don't even watch TV, and I love to watch movies. We always are doing things. You want to do homework? Get a good book, go to a library. And I believe that all this new technology is out of control. You look at people on the street, you look at people on the subway, everybody with the dang keyboard, texting. It's crazy. It's out of control, and I hate it.
You definitely have pointed out something that I think does cause a lot of anxiety, that people feel that kids, and Shelley has talked about this concern that children are getting addicted or drawn away from technology, or drawn away from quote unquote real life through technology. Francisco, do you have a policy of keeping your technology out of the home?
I don't want to. I went to college. I graduated from college. I use my computer. And if I get one, it will be to do research for the homework, and that's it. You know how many perverts are in Facebook? You want to meet friends? Go to the park, go to the school, friends that I can see, friends that I can deal with. Because all this thing with Facebook and Twitter, I don't understand it. I don't want to know nothing about it. I wouldn't even know where to start looking, who they're talking to.
Francisco, thank you for your call. Do you feel that Francisco is a voice in the wilderness, or do you hear a lot of that from parents?
That is a common concern, that technology is going to disrupt and take away from our relationships, or take away from the relationship that we have to the natural world. I think a lot of parents are trying to find that balance, as we heard from the first caller. But the other thing about technology and the way we use media, it reflects our values. It reflects often our personal histories or what our experiences are. And so it's not surprising that somebody who values being outside and values face-to-face interaction may set up an environment in the home that reflects that. And so I think he's voicing, Francisco, you're voicing so much of what many parents experience, although others make other decisions about what to do with that response.
You talk about finding a balance, and yet I can imagine that it's very elusive indeed, because there's what you want your kids to do and there's what your kids want to do. You maybe want to see them outside more and try to set up situations in which they are outside more. Perhaps your kid's overweight and you really want them to get out there and start moving, but they fight you tooth and nail. They want to be indoors. They want to be on the computer, Facebooking or working on school projects or whatever. Any tips on negotiating those sticking points?
Well, also, I think one thing is to see that technology may be maybe a tool in thinking about movement. And, you know, we've heard a lot about Kinect and Wii and some of the gestural games, but also thinking about how the gameplay, if let's say the kickball in Wii leads to playing kickball outside and having a conversation about how those two are related. I mean, it's no surprise that there is an epidemic in obesity in this country. I think it was a brilliant move on Michelle Obama's part with her Let's Move campaign and how she took the tools of social networking and other media to promote that campaign. You know, I had a couple of nephews in the Midwest and my sister who's a middle school teacher on the West Coast, and they were connected thinking about whether Beyonce was going to visit their school, and when they were doing the flash mob and the dance, and then being able to see the video clips on YouTube, it didn't keep them from dancing any less watching the video. Instead, they felt connected. And so instead of pitting one against the other, I think is probably a more effective way to go.
Emily from Harlem, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show. Hi, Emily.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I have to say I'm in agreement with the recent caller. He's not in the wilderness. And I'm only 30, so I'm not that far from the generation who are using these things. But Shelley was talking about kids enjoying time together and connecting through technology and social media. But I find that what many people don't talk about is the underlying sort of competitive and superficial nature of these networks, and kids and adults both are sort of constantly looking at every movement of each other's lives on these websites, their boyfriends and girlfriends and how they look in their pictures and what they've accomplished and not. And even kids, I'm wondering, you know, how does this really affecting their self-esteem? Because what it actually encourages is everybody sort of comparing their insides to everybody else's outsides, and it can really, you know, there's this superficial picture of that everybody can portray, and it may not be what's really going on inside. So how is that impacting how kids are judging and comparing themselves?
Emily, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
It's a great set of points that you're making, and I certainly don't stand as the technology apologist or necessarily the champion to say that technology is going to save many of the entrenched problems that we have in our society. At the same time, though, I do think it's important to wonder what of this is new.
Right. Bullying has been around for a long time.
Right. There are
comparing,
different
you know, the social pressure to dress a certain way and come to school looking a certain way certainly was around when I was a kid, and we didn't have iPads and cell phones.
That's right. So it's not necessarily – these aren't new problems created by technology. They may be we may be viewing them differently, and certainly the magnification of the number of people that you might be exposed to. So the 500 kids, you know, it may be that when you were an adolescent, you wanted to have 500 kids that you could claim as your friend, and now that's possible through the lens of Facebook. But those same feelings of insecurity and do I fit in, those are core aspects of development that were not manufactured by an iPad or by a smartphone.
And yet, aren't the stakes higher? Those same 500 friends can get an embarrassing cell phone video clip of you within seconds, and that can go viral and just be devastating to your reputation, to your feelings about yourself.
And that is something that's new. I think the recording of experiences is not something that many of us would have been possible in previous generations. So when you go to a concert, let's say, you know, and this is something that I think John Schaefer was talking about a couple weeks ago, you know, our concert's dead and everyone pulling up their phone and they're not listening to the music. Instead, they're recording the experience.
Oh, I saw. Yeah, this really dates me. I was at a Pat Benatar concert and that's what everybody was doing. This one woman was holding up her iPad and filming it. So it was all mediated through the lens of a cell phone or an iPhone or an iPad.
That's right. And when the content that's being captured is potentially embarrassing or, as you say, devastating to the person who's being filmed, that is very different. But the root feelings of acceptance and am I going to be held accountable for my most embarrassing moments, that instead it doesn't linger in the memories of those people who were present, but it could be available and known to a much wider audience. All the more reason, though, to engage young people in a conversation about media literacy and media engagement and asking questions about what is appropriate and, you know, what is it that we want to create right now?
Yeah, what kind of ground rules? Say you're having that discussion with your 13-year-old. What kind of ground rules do you set out for them? I know celebrities have ground rules, right? Like people are, you know, they show up at these after-hours nightclubs or something, and people's cell phones are confiscated for mm-hmm. that moment, you know. But you can't do that as a kid. What kind of ground rules can you advise your kid to lay down for themselves with regards to this possibility of having somebody tweet an embarrassing photo of them or an embarrassing video clip of them?
I think probably to start with how they want to be treated, I think is probably the first point of the conversation is, you know, is that the way you would want, you know, would you want a photo of yourself to be posted in this compromising position? But also to encourage young people to talk to one another about what their rules may be, because one group of 13-year-old, let's say, girls living in Brooklyn may have a different experience or a different set of expectations than a group of boys living in Texas. You know, not necessarily.
How do you mean?
Well, that the different cultural norms or different gender norms, you know, that instead of thinking that one set of rules is going to apply to everyone, get them involved in the co-creation of what those rules may be.
Let's take Serena from Manhattan. Serena, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I pretty much think I have a handle on controlling her computer use because I use the parental controls. I keep the computer in a public place, the living room area, so you know I can kind of monitor what's going on there. But I wanted to know, you suggested that we have conversations with kids when it's age appropriate, as to how they should limit themselves and control themselves on the computer. When do you suggest we do this? At what age would an adolescent be mature enough to sort of be able to understand and not only understand but also accept and be willing to utilize certain rules so that they can control, you know, how their image is presented on the computer, and they can control how much they use the computer, you know, the quality of the time that they're using on the computer.
Thanks for your call, Serena.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there's a specific age, but I would imagine that your 17-year-old is probably ready for that conversation and perhaps beyond ready, that as children get older and their friends become increasingly important in their lives and in many ways are influencing in the decisions that they make, and that starts to happen in really in elementary school but certainly takes off in middle school and is in full force in high school, then that's the time to start talking to them about what are they experiencing, what are they seeing, what are their, you know, what are their friends up to, and having that conversation. That the parental controls and expecting the technology to make decisions is probably not the place that would be encouraging of the relationship that you're wanting to foster, that, you know, may be open and really letting your daughter know what it is you value and hearing from her, because we make all sorts of assumptions about kids. And we talk about kids and teens as though they're
not in the room.
They're not in the room. And also they're all of a part, or, you know, that they there's such a thing as the normal teen or the typical adolescent. Instead, really hearing from them and not assuming that we know what they're up to in Facebook or what they're doing in Tumblr.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine it's a lot like talking to kids about sex. You want to talk about it early and often, but in an age-appropriate manner. You don't want to have this conversation about appropriateness on the internet in some finite point in time. You really want to be talking about that from the get-go.
And it's, as you're saying, it's much more organic. It's not a single conversation.
Right.
Who would have anticipated smartphones, you know, 10 years ago? And the way that we can be connected. Many parents bought their children a cell phone for the first time because they wanted to be connected. They wanted to help negotiate pickup time or drop-off time. And then lo and behold, the young person starts using in ways that couldn't have been anticipated. I mean, who would have thought we would have seen the tens of thousands of text messages coming from adolescents? And so they're adapting the technology to fit their needs. So talking to them over time about how this is shifting and, you know, what's new for them, what new websites are they visiting, or what new social networks are they exploring?
We've got some comments on our website. Catherine in Garden City wrote, as with everything, moderation is key. I have a 9-month-old son and a husband who is a technologist, so it's inevitable that my son will eventually use technology. We have plenty of hard copy books, but we also read books to him on the iPad, and the visuals are amazing. And Larry from Brooklyn left this comment on our show page. All learning involves rewiring of the brain. Without brain changes, there would be no learning or memory at all. There is nothing fundamentally different about the brain changes that occur in while watching a video game than that which occurs while reading a book or interacting with another person. And I think that, Shelley, goes to your point of we're not focusing so much on that New York Times concern about the distracted brain, mm-hmm. but that human beings evolve and change and shift all the time. And we're adapting as we go along.
That's true, and our media formats are changing. So in the comments posted on the website, and this is something we even heard from President Obama, we tend to elevate the book. What is a book these days? Is it something that exists on paper? Is it something that we're reading on our Nook or on our Kindle? And so it really calls into question, how are we going to engage, and what do we value? What media formats do we value and feel safe that make us feel superior or make us feel intelligent? And what are the ones that we think are just for fun or for play? And really breaking down those categories, because it's getting blurrier and blurrier by the moment.
What about the ones that make us feel cool, Shelley? It's all about feeling cool with your latest iPhone or iPad. Shelley Pasnik is director of the Center for Children and Technology. Thank you so much for guiding our discussion on children and technology and family life. The conversation continues on our show page. That's WNYC.org. Click on the Leonard LoPage Show. Thank you so much, Shelley, for joining us.
Thanks so much to you.
This is WNYC.